In the summer of 1804, two of America's most eminent statesmen squared off, pistols raised on a bluff along the Hudson River. The two such men would risk not only their lives, but the stability of the young country they helped forge is almost beyond comprehension. Yet, we know that it happened. The question is why? In his new book, War of Two, journalist and biographer John Sedgwick explores the long-standing conflict between Founding Father Alexander Hamilton and Vice President Aaron Burr. A study in contrast from birth, they had been compatriots, colleagues, and even friends. But above all, they were rivals, matching each other's ambition and skill as lawyers in New York. They later battled for power along political fault lines that would not only decide the future of the United States, but define it. The name of the book is War of Two, and it's a pleasure to welcome John Sedgwick to the roundtable this morning. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, it's a pleasure for me.
Very nice to have you here. What brought you to the story of Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr?
Oh, my goodness. There's so many different reasons. But the one that's really most striking is the fact that it turns out that Alexander Hamilton's last letter that he wrote before he rode or was rowed across the Hudson River to be shot at Weehawken on July 11th, 1804, many years ago now, that last letter was written to a direct ancestor of mine named Theodore Sedgwick, and it said some surprising things about the duel that I don't think historians fully credit. And when I saw that letter in an archive in Massachusetts, I was just so stunned. It seemed like it was a letter to me. You know, sometimes you see these historical documents and they seem so immediate and you make this connection. They're almost like these wormholes that join present to past and in this kind of miraculous way, and that was one of them.
What was it about that letter, and what was it about the tone that illuminated this for you and started you asking questions?
Well, it's funny. The letter was in two halves, and the first half was very chatty. It was like, oh, so nice to be thinking of you again. Yeah, it was incredible in retrospect. But I've had your letter here, Theodore, for some time, and I just have a few minutes now to reply to it. I'm hoping to write you more a longer letter later. And, of course, that time never came. But then he goes into a couple of points that surely had direct bearing on what was about to happen to him. And one, because they were both about Burr, even though the name Burr does not appear in the letter. The first was that he said it would break his heart if this empire of ours, meaning the country, were to be dismembered. Dismembered, of course, means have chunks of it taken away. And that, why should he say that? Well, not too long before, the rumor had circulated, and it was a credible rumor, that Burr was going to be part of a conspiracy, the Northern Conspiracy, as it was called, that would involve detaching New England and New York into a new nation that would be a neighbor and potentially an ally, but maybe a rival of the existing United States. It would be separated. And with Burr as the president, that was startling as a motivation. You know, clearly that was on his mind when he went to the duel because he'd written it just hours before the duel occurred. And the other thing was that he said that he was worried about the democracy, not for the reasons that you would think. He was worried about democracy because there seemed to be too much of it. A very odd and unexpected thing for the founder of our republic to say. But what he meant by it was not democracy as we think of it, but more mobocracy, an uninformed electorate being swayed by the manipulations of unscrupulous men, of demagogues, and that he was very worried that such people like Burr would be able to sway the people to their own ends and not to the ends of a great nation. And that was what he had against Burr. Burr, you know, was the first to do sort of house-to-house campaigning. All the other candidates up to that point had done their campaigning through surrogates. They never saw the electorate at all.
What's fascinating about the two of them is that they're climbing this political ladder, and they're both very successful in their own right. But as you point out in the book, the space that they start to climb in becomes smaller and smaller and tighter and tighter.
Exactly. Well, for one thing, it's important to remember it was a really small country. If you looked at it on a map, it would be mostly green wilderness with just a few specks of quote-unquote civilization along the shore and inland, in Albany, for example. But, you know, the population was tiny, and so that there weren't very many positions of leadership, and that the qualified, and there were more people of qualification than there were spots. I mean, it's always the case, but there was, but it was intensely that way then. And so essentially, that as those two men rose, they came from utterly different perspective. Hamilton was a penniless immigrant when he came to New York. Aaron Burr was anything but. He was set up. He was the son of the president of Princeton, the grandson of Jonathan Edwards, the greatest theologian of the day and the equivalent of a rock star, I mean, truly, in those times. And that he couldn't have been more set up, more made, and that Hamilton couldn't have been less set up and less made. A natural rivalry, antagonism along class lines. And then it just continued in every possible scale. One was very open, the other was very closed. One had powerful political beliefs, the other had no political belief. And as they rose in politics and in power, they came closer and closer into contact, and that, you know, that Hamilton ultimately emerged as a kingmaker. He was the one to select Washington to be president and to encourage him to do it. He was in that position, and that Burr, of course, came within an inch of being elected president himself. These were the very peak of political society, and that they couldn't have been more different.
Of course, the very nature of a duel indicates that one person will live, one person will die.
Not necessarily. I mean, they could both die, or they could both not die. I mean, it happens in most cases, and it's an odd thing to contemplate as to just why. But usually one person is better at it than the other, and so that person wins. Burr was clearly better at it than Hamilton. But, you know, it's a funny thing to think. I mean, it's also, I love thinking about this. 10 yards is not a great distance. That's a first down. I mean, you can see somebody's eyes. You can see a little flicker of tension on their face when you're staring at them with the gun raised. You know, I mean, it's such an intimate way to die. And also that by the nature of the duel, that the person who is, that these are people that get to choose the person who's going to kill them. How odd is that? You know, and that they know each other. I mean, it's one thing in battle to fight someone that you don't know, but in such a way to fight someone that you do know and have known for decades. That, I think, is a very odd thing, and I can't think of anything quite like it in a formal sense. Obviously, you know, as you think about it, though, murders are often among intimates. They usually, you know, I mean, criminal justice people will tell you that it's the person who's likely to kill you is somebody who does know you, and maybe right. That factors into this. But in a formal setting, with them looking at each other, it's really uncanny.
But in this case, there has to be such an intense hatred to want to be able to put themselves into that situation.
Yes. I think the way it went was that Hamilton hated Burr first, and Burr hated Hamilton late. That Hamilton was always digging at Burr, always. I mean, he had nothing good to say about him. Every election cycle, every time there was a presidential campaign, Hamilton would come out with something just awful about Burr, either said privately or even publicly. And that Burr would never respond. He just wouldn't deign to do that. He was a gentleman about it, basically. And then finally, the difference was that their careers both went into decline, and Burr took it much harder, I think, even than Hamilton did. And he was touchy about his standing, and that when Hamilton called him a dangerous man, he thought, well, I'm not going to take this. You know, I've had it with you. You've caused me enough trouble in my life. You've embarrassed me so completely that I'm just going to rub you out. I don't think that Hamilton would ever have challenged Burr to a duel. There was no indication that he did. And that I think that he was a little taken aback when Burr finally said enough. So that at that point, Burr, I think, was absolutely intent on exterminating Hamilton, being done with him, rubbing him out of history. And Hamilton was kind of baffled, and he had no particular intention of killing Burr. I really think that he didn't aim at him.
It's just really incredible to think that a founding father is dead and the sitting vice president is a fugitive.
It is absolutely incredible. There is no an analog in all of American history that's like that. I think the closest thing that comes to mind in my own generation is Watergate, where it turned out that the president of the United States was directing a criminal campaign, and then a cover up on top of it. I mean, that's the closest that I know of or can remember where the president really was any kind of criminal. And Ford pardoned Nixon, but there could have been charges leveled against him. That's the equivalent. And think what an uproar that made. You know, I mean, that really was convulsed the country for not just then, but for years to come. And it altered people's perception of government, not just of Nixon. It was, I think at that point, people raised a suspicion about the conduct of government that has never fully been erased. And that something similar happened to Burr personally. He wasn't a representative of the government in doing what he did, but he was the sitting vice president, and he did take the long fall. And he was trying to grasp on, to hang on to the power that he had, what little it remained. And I think that he, to restore himself sort of egotistically, is why he embarked on this lunatic campaign to detach the Western lands from the rest of the United States and create and raise the largest and most severe secessionary campaign that would be in the United States until the Civil War. He was going to take half the country and be for his own private empire, that with him as the stated emperor, his daughter as his empress, and his grandson as the heir apparent. That was the scheme.
As far as the tone this sets for American politics in its infancy, is one of great partisanship and also personal attack.
Yes, but you know, one of the things about a duel is that it closes off the personal attack, you know, abruptly. It's an irony that something so vicious and so abhorrent should actually have this kind of cleansing effect. That's the end of the argument, you know. Hamilton and Burr stopped chewing at each other when Hamilton was killed. It doesn't go on and on as it does in our politics, where, you know, Tea Party people go after the leadership of their own party or of the other party, and there's this constant bickering and what we saw on the stage of in the presidential debate the other day, where Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush sort of have it in for each other, and that's going to go on for, you know, could go on for decades. It wouldn't. With a duel, it's done. And also with a duel, there's a constraining effect. I mean, the people know where the limit is as a rule, and they don't go over it because they realize that it would be the end of them, literally.
You're not advocating for that.
Of course I am. I think we should bring back dueling. It's one of my campaigns. No, I don't think so. It's rather dire, but it was not without some benefits.
When you look at just our interest recently in Alexander Hamilton, having a lot to do with the hit Broadway show Hamilton.
Absolutely.
What do you make of that phenomenon and the fact that, I mean, obviously it's a beautiful piece of art, but also there's a great story there as well.
There is a great story, and it's funny. It's not the real story. It's a great story, as most great stories aren't the real story. The first thing I'll say is that I don't think Hamilton has ever been so popular as he is today. It's an amazing thing. I mean, partly because the country is so much bigger, there are more people to be popular with. But it's also true that people will get behind Hamilton and through that musical in ways they never did personally at the time that he was living. People believed in him only because they believed in his ideas and his advocacy of them. They didn't really believe in him personally. He wasn't likable, I don't think. But he was, but as portrayed in this musical, this up from nothing, scrappy immigrant who's determined to make his name and make his way in a kind of alien society. I mean, that's an American story. It's the immigrant story that really wasn't Hamilton's story. Hamilton was an elitist from the very beginning, and that he would never have identified with the up and coming. He hated the up and coming. He identified with the elite and the establishment and the moneyed class. And if he walked into a party, he'd be the one who was best dressed. He wouldn't be in any kind of tatters. And that is the Hamilton of record. So there's that. But the thing is about the musical that's so fascinating to me is that, of course, these are all the actors are, or almost all of them, are people of color. And so there's kind of this rainbow for the founding fathers who originally, of course, were lily white, one end to the other. And that what's amazing is that it captures more truth with the colored performers than it would have if they were all white. And it's because our understanding of white, our definition of white, has changed so completely. Back then, of course, it was normal, quote unquote. It was what everybody was used to. Of course they were white. But now the colors represent the tumult, the immigrant status that everyone actually had back then, but they didn't fully acknowledge, but was part of it. Everybody came from different places. This was a country that was not formed, that it was being formed by these people, as immigrants can form our country by coming from different perspectives. And it's that tumult of the show, of the hip-hop music, all this torrent of words and the convulsiveness of it that really captures a lot of what it was like to be alive at that time.
The name of the book is War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned the Nation. The book is published by Berkeley. John Sedgwick, a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, War of Two, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and the Duel That Stunned the Nation. It's published by Berkeley. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.